From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
And I want to say something else specific to you, Mr. President. It's true, you can humiliate, and you can hound, and you can smash, and burn, and terrify, and smirk, and boast, and defame, and demonize, and dismiss, and incinerate, and starve. And yes, you can force somebody, force a people to surrender what happens to remain of their bloody bowels into your grasping, bony, dry hands. But all of us who are weak, we watch you, and we learn from your hatred, and we do not forget. And we are many, Mr. President. We are most of the people on this godforsaken planet.
Today, a tribute to the great poet, activist, scholar, June Jordan. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Israel announced early today it will seize new Palestinian land in response to every future attack and hold it as long as violence continues. Israeli forces invaded the West Bank cities of Jenin, Nablus, Qalqilya, and Hebron overnight, with helicopter gunships firing from above. The action comes after the latest suicide bombing, which killed 20 people in Jerusalem. Palestinian Cabinet Minister Saeb Erekat says Ariel Sharon is trying to foil any international effort aimed at reviving the peace process before such an effort begins. Erekat said Sharon wants to, quote, end the peace process, destroy the Palestinian Authority, replace it with the Israeli civil administration, and to press ahead with the occupation. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's inner cabinet decided against sending Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat into exile after intelligence experts strongly warned against the move. But Israeli radio is reporting today officials are preparing to expel senior figures in the Palestinian Authority. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting President Bush plans in the coming days to propose the establishment of a Palestinian state with provisional boundaries. Negotiations over permanent borders would be completed within 3 years. An international conference would adopt the plan in September. But all of this is provided the Palestinian security forces are revamped and violence against Israeli civilians reduced. Attorneys for John Walker Lynn say a court should throw out statements he made in Afghanistan because U.S. officials coerced the information out of him while he was confined in a shipping container and prevented from seeing a lawyer. Lynn is a 21-year-old Californian man captured in Afghanistan while fighting with the Taliban. The lawyers charged the government intentionally prolonged his imprisonment and blocked messages from his attorneys, specifically in order to interrogate him unchecked, without Lynn knowing whether any neutral party or advocate would ever intercede. The lawyers say at the U.S. military's Camp Rhino in Kandahar, Lynn was stripped naked, blindfolded, taped to a stretcher, held in a metal shipping container without light or heat. A military investigation has found that an F-16 pilot mistakenly bombed Canadian soldiers because he did not follow official procedures and take time to assess the threat properly before striking. 4 Canadians were killed in the bombing. The pilot, Major Harry Schmidt, is a seasoned former Navy pilot and instructor at the Navy's elite Top Gun school. A Kurdish leader said Tuesday Kurds in northern Iraq will refuse to cooperate with any U.S.-inspired covert action to topple Saddam Hussein. Masoud Barzani said the Iraqi issue won't be solved by military or covert action and called for transparency and clarity in reform efforts. Barzani's comments came in response to a Washington Post expose revealing the CIA has launched a new covert action to topple Hussein with explicit permission from the White House to assassinate him. 2 new studies by international agencies blame rich Western governments for sending the world's poorest people into increased poverty and suffering. A new UN study reports that more than 100 million people will be dragged below the basic subsistence level of a dollar a day by 2015 as they become ensnared in globalization's poverty trap. The report rejects claims that globalization is good for the poor and argues the international trade and economic system is part of the problem, not the solution. Meanwhile, a new study by the International Red Cross and the Red Crescent reports developing countries face increasing danger from natural disasters because of the arrogance and myopic vision of aid donors. The World Disaster Report accuses Western governments of wasting vast amounts on often self-aggrandizing rescue operations in response to disasters that are preventable. The reluctance of donors to finance preventive measures means the number of people affected by disasters is expected to rise sharply. The number of disaster victims has tripled since the 1970s. Peruvian anti-privatization protesters have called a national strike as prosecutors investigate allegations that the Belgian buyer of two state-owned electrical plants bribed former President Alberto Fujimori with $10 million. 5 days of protests have spread across most of southern Peru. Protesters say the privatization will cause layoffs and increase utility prices. President Alejandro Toledo promised in writing during his campaign not to privatize the electrical plants. Pharmaceutical companies are among 21 corporate donors paying $250,000 each for a multi-million dollar Republican fundraising gala to be hosted by President Bush in Washington tonight. This comes 2 days after Republicans in Congress announced a prescription drug plan backed by the industry. And the White House has submitted to Congress legislation that would require the FBI and CIA to turn over intelligence reports on terrorist threats to the proposed Department of Homeland Security. The bill would also remove the State Department's traditional authority to issue visas and transfer it to the new department.
It's no more. Oksha.
Auction block, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. This is a Pacifica special, the State of the World 2002, War, Peace, and Human Rights, on Pacifica stations around the country, a special full day, 15 hours of programming. Today is Juneteenth, the oldest known celebration of the end of slavery in the United States. The holiday dates back to the last days of the Civil War, when Union soldiers landed in Galveston, Texas, with news that the war had ended and slaves were free. The date was June 19th, 1865. The news of freedom came to Galveston's Africans enslaved more than 2 years after Abraham Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. Some say slaveholders deliberately withheld the news to maintain the labor force on the plantations. Others say federal troops delayed the news and waited to enforce Lincoln's order so slave owners could reap the benefits of one last cotton harvest. It was General Gordon Granger who finally delivered the news of freedom. Thousands flooded the streets of Galveston, dancing and singing, where Granger read a statement aloud. The celebration of Juneteenth was born. The observance of June 19th has spread across the United States, and today over 150 cities and 30 states celebrate this Emancipation Day. Today, the Pacifica Network has dedicated the entire day to programming around Juneteenth. And today on Democracy Now!, we're going to observe Juneteenth by paying tribute to a woman who lived her life as a call to freedom and a hymn for justice. She used poetry to emancipate, essays to educate, her voice to empower. She seemed to embrace each day as a June 19th, offering both a promise of democracy and vision of struggle. I'm talking about June Jordan, the poet, the activist, the essayist, teacher. She died on Friday at her home in Berkeley, California. She'd been battling breast cancer for nearly a decade. She was 65 years old. June Jordan is the most published African-American writer in history. She burst onto the literary and political scene in the late 1960s on the wings of the civil rights and anti-war movements. Poetry for her was a political act. She used it to shine a fierce light on racism, sexism, homophobia, apartheid, poverty, U.S. foreign policy. Author Toni Morrison once summed up her career as 40 years of tireless activism coupled with and fueled by flawless art. Today, we'll be joined by some of June Jordan's dearest friends and colleagues, including the great writer Alice Walker. Laura Flanders joins us in the studio here in New York. Junichi Sumitsu has continued her poetry for the People Project in California. Angela Davis will be with us from California. But we're going to start with June Jordan's own words, a poem that June wrote 10 years ago about the Middle East. Could have been written yesterday. It's called Intifada.
Intifada. In detention, in concentration camps, we trade stories, we take turns sharing the straw mat or a pencil. We watch what crawls in and out of the sand. Assalamu alaikum. The guards do not allow the blue woolen blanket my family traveled far to bring to this crepuscular and gelid cell where my still-breathing infant son and I defy the purgatory implications of a state-created hell. Wa alaikum assalam. The village trembles from the heavy tanks that try to terrify the children. Every day, my little brother runs behind the rubble, practicing the tactics of the stones against the rock. In January, soldiers broke his fingers one by one. Time has healed his hands, but not the fury that controls what used to be his heart. Inshallah, close the villages, close the clinics, close the school, close the house, close the windows of the house, kill the vegetables languishing under the sun, kill the milk of the cows left to the swelling of pain, cut the electricity, cut the telephones, confine the people to the people. Do not despair of the mercy of Allah. Fig trees will grow and oranges erupt from desert holdings on which plastic bullets, 70% zinc, 20% glass, and 10% plastic will prove blood soluble and fertilize the earth where sheep will graze and women no longer grieve and beat their breasts. They will beat clean, fine woven rugs outside a house smelling of cinnamon and nutmeg. Alhamdulillah, so says Iman, the teacher of peace, the shepherd on the mountain of the Lamb, the teacher of peace who will subdue the howling of the lion so that we may kneel as we must five times, beginning just after dawn and ending just before dusk in the ibadah of prayer. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Intifada, June Jordan. June Jordan died last Friday. She was born, though, on July 9th, 1936, in Harlem. She went to Barnard College, the alma mater of Zora Neale Hurston. In 1957, she graduated and then went on to the University of Chicago, Chicago, where Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gwendolyn Brooks hailed from, playwright Lorraine Hansberry. Her writing, her political awareness grew. And her first book of poetry, Who Look at Me, was published in 1969. In 1972, June published her biography of Fannie Lou Hamer. It was aimed at students. The book filled a void in the curriculum of most public education institutions. Over the next decade, June wrote critically acclaimed collections, including Some Changes and Things That I Do in the Dark. And she continued to write in local publications as well as national magazines. For the last, more than a decade, she was a professor of African American Studies at the University of Berkeley, University of California, Berkeley. And today we will be talking to a group of her friends. Alice Walker joining us, the great writer Angela Davis will be with us, the man who's carried on her poetry for the People Project, Junichi Sumitsu. But we're going to begin right here in New York with Laura Flanders, who's just come back from California, where she has spent a good deal of time with June Jordan on this Juneteenth day. Laura, I know this has been a very, very hard week for you since June died. Can you talk about the significance of the day and the woman?
Oh, I just think it's the perfect day to talk about June Jordan. The day that so many enslaved Africans found that they were liberated, could be no better day to talk about the message that June Jordan brought us. She was always a source of good news, certainly in my life, a daybreak, just as I thought things were very, very gloomy, just when I thought the news couldn't get worse, there would be June with her righteous anger, but always the laugh, always the smile. She believed that we had to believe in a better life. We had to believe and extend our hands to all of those Americans and around the world people who were working to realize the promise of equality, of freedom. She believed you could draw no line when it came to equality or freedom. And if you tried to draw a line, some for you but not for that other person, more for this one, less for that one, then you better watch your back. You better watch out. June's message was, we the people is us. We are no longer, she wrote once, minorities or fringe elements or special interests. We have become the people. And in her work, which was all about smile, be beautiful, be raging, be furious, but be proud, be excited, to be glad to be part of this project, she wrote of Dr. King something that I think was completely true of June Jordan. She wrote of King that because he taught us the value of our lives, we have become capable of saving them. And that's what June did. She taught each of us individually, those of us who knew her, the value of our lives. She believed so adamantly in our worth that eventually we had to take ourselves as seriously as she did. And there are now thousands, I would say hundreds of thousands of people who have been stiffened in their spines by June's belief in them, have come to believe in themselves, maybe not quite as much as she did, but almost. We're getting there. And although I can't believe she's no longer on this planet in her physical form, she's here. Her spirit is here, and it's a spirit of Juneteenth-type good news.
Laura Flanders, she wrote the book, Real Majority, Media Minority, The Cost of Sidelining Women in Reporting, and is a host of Working Assets Radio on KLW in San Francisco. Alice Walker is also on the line with us, the great writer, poet, civil rights activist, author of, among many other books, The Color Purple, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. Among her other books, In Search of Our Mother's Gardens, The Temple of My Familiar, Possessing the Secret of Joy, In Love and Trouble, Stories of Black Women. Alice, welcome to Democracy Now! Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. A difficult time, but also a day to celebrate. It's hard to say the memory of a woman, but can you talk about June Jordan, the June Jordan you knew?
I really met June when I was living in Mississippi, and it was a very, very hard, difficult time in the 70s, the early 70s. And she came, and she was doing a piece on those of us who were, you know, there in a struggle, and also she came to meet Mrs. Hamer. And we bonded because she was very concerned, you know, that we feel connected to the larger world, which, of course, we did not, being in Mississippi. And it is that protectiveness, that is the quality that I most think of when I think of June, that she put those small shining arms around people who seemed to need it. And at that time, I was one of them. And so I became her little sister in a way. And we have had a friendship for over 30 years that grew out of her coming to this very terrible place and being this very bright, warm light. She was very loving and saw everything, it seemed to me, and had such a passion to tell the world about the suffering of the world. She was always telling the world about its own suffering, which is one way of bringing it to the light, to consciousness, so that things can be changed.
We played Entifada, the poem of June Jordan. In fact, her very early outspoken stance on Palestinian issues really threatened her career. Laura, could you talk about that?
Well, I think she didn't think of it that way exactly. She saw a wrong being done against a people, the Palestinian people, and a wrong being done against Palestinian people that she felt would have repercussions for people everywhere, Jews, not Jews. She was very concerned in the last years of her life, the last weeks and months of her life, about a rising tide of anti-Semitism that she thought would follow upon the U.S. support of Israeli policies against Palestinians. She saw it simply, she told the truth. That was her mandate, her mission in life, to tell the truth. And in 1982, when Israeli forces invaded southern Lebanon and were bombing around the clock Beirut, and the news leaked out of the Israeli-assisted, facilitated, perhaps even ordered massacre in the refugee camps of Shatila and Sabra, she wrote a poem. She wrote several poems, but one of them, the most memorable of that moment, was an apology to all the people of Lebanon, in which she pointed out that every explanation for the Israeli action in Lebanon had been proven to be a lie. She talked about the humanity of the Lebanese people, the Palestinians in the refugee camps, the wrongness of the bombing. She continued to write what she saw to be true, and to say, as I said before, you cannot have freedom for some and not for others. You cannot have justice for some and not for others. You cannot simply decide that some people are less human, that some people don't deserve land, water, love, health care, education, deserve their voices to be listened to. She wrote things as she saw them, but at that time in 82 was no comfortable time to be speaking out for Palestinian rights or for Palestinian people or for saying we, the Palestinians. It was not a phrase that you heard or didn't pay a price for articulating. She paid a price. I think she believed, and others would confirm this, that her role, which at that point had been to be a regular contributor to some of this country's mainstream newspapers, the New York Times, to name just one, her role was suddenly shifted into becoming a kind of outsider, somebody who was no longer welcome on the op-ed pages, somebody who had to struggle to get her books the kind of attention and respect that they deserved. 28 books. And yet when she offered to speak out about the Gulf War, when she offered her opinions on the U.S. war now against Afghanistan, she was not welcome on the op-ed pages. And I think that her career was absolutely affected by her forthright, adamant stand for equal rights for everybody against supremacist thinking of all kinds. But she was still, her last piece that she wrote for the Book of Essays coming out this fall, Some of Us Did Not Die, is about Israel-Palestine, is about the killing of Danny Pearl, is about the dangers of anti-Semitism and of anti-Islamic thinking in this country. She was adamantly concerned with this issue until her death.
We're going to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we're going to hear a speech of June Jordan's and then come back to this discussion. You are listening to Democracy Now!, our guests, Laura Flanders. She is host of Working Assets Radio on KLW in San Francisco, and Alice Walker, the great writer. We're talking about June Jordan. Stay with us.
Thank you.
African Children's Choir from the beloved film soundtrack. I am Amy Goodman talking about the life and legacy of June Jordan as we go right back to June. It is hard to think of the fact that she died last Friday of breast cancer at her home in Berkeley, California. But this is June in March of 1991, speaking out against the Persian Gulf War in Hayward, California. It was recorded from Pacifica's Peace Watch program.
This is the column that I wrote on the night that was, among other things, the anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X last Thursday. On a recent cold Sunday morning in Kennebunk, Maine, George Bush and his wife, Barbara, apparently seated themselves inside a small country Church of God to think about what? Alma Powell, wife of the Joint Chief Commander of the United States Armed Forces, reports that she likes to keep comforting foods like vegetable soup ready on top of the stove for Colin, her certainly hardworking husband. Alma adds that these days she just knows that her Colin doesn't want to hear little stories about the children. Just the soup, ma'am. Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney, second only to his boss in bloodthirst for arms-length armchair warfare, has never served half an hour even in the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or the Marines. I know, it's not right to pick on him just for that. Last Saturday, at a local anti-war rally organized by the Middle East Children's Alliance, I noted aloud that the war to date was costing us $56 billion every 24 hours. The cost is $1 billion at least. I therefore proposed the following to the crowd scattered on the grass and under the trees. $1 billion a day for 7 days for Oakland. Can you imagine that? $1 billion a day, but to hell with the imagination. This is our city. This is our money. These are our lives. $1 billion a day for 7 days for Oakland. Or do we accept that there is only the will and the wallet when it's about kill or be killed? Do we need this money or not? Do we need it here? Do we need it now? And so on. When I left the stage, a reporter came up to me. You meant $1 million, didn't you? No, I answered him amazed, $1 billion. $1 billion a day for 7 days for Oakland. That's the bill. That's our bill for housing and drug rehabilitation and books in the public schools and hospital care and all of that good stuff. $1 billion a day. It's a modest proposal. In less than 3 months, those maniacs in the White House and the Pentagon have spent $56 billion in my name and with my taxes trying to obliterate Iraq and its people and their leader. I'm saying call home the troops and the bucks. We need these big bucks to make this a homeland, not a desert, right here for the troops and for you and for me. What's the problem? It's a bargain. $7 billion on the serious improvement of American life in Oakland versus $56 billion for death and destruction inside Iraq. What's the problem? But the reporter was giving me a weak smile of farewell that let me understand he found my proposal preposterous. $1 million for life, okay. Billions for kill or be killed, okay. But really big bucks on us, the people of these United States. $1 billion a day to promote, for example, the safety and educational attainment and communal happiness of 339,000 Americans. I must be kidding. As I walked away from the park, I felt a heavy depression overtaking me. The reporter, a tall white man with clear eyes, could not contemplate the transfer of his and my aggregate resources from death to life as a reasonable idea. Worse, he could not suppose his and my life to be worth anything close to the value of organized, high-tech, and boastful murder. But then other people stopped me to ask, how can we do that? Do we write letters or what? And so, as I write this column tonight, I am reassured because not every American has lost her mind or his soul. Not every one of my compatriots has become a flag-wrapped lunatic lusting after oil, power, the perversions of kicking ass, preferably via TV. A huge number of Americans has joined with enormous numbers of Arab peoples and European communities in Germany, England, France, Italy, Spain, and Muslim communities throughout India and Pakistan to cry out, stop. And when I say huge, I mean it. If 1,000 Americans contacted by some pollster can be said to represent 250 million people, then how many multi-millions do we, anti-war movement gatherings of more than 100,000 coast to coast and on every continent, how many do we represent? How come nobody ever does that kind of political math? And tonight, February 2nd, 1991, when yet again the ruling white men of America despise peace and sneer at negotiations and intensify their arm's-length armchair prosecution of this evil war, this display of a racist value system that will never allow for any nationalism that is not their own, and that will never allow third world countries to control their own natural resources, and that will never ever express, let alone feel regret or remorse or shame or horror at the loss of any human life that is not white. Tonight, I am particularly proud to be an African American. By launching the heaviest air assault in history against Iraq on January 15th, George Bush dared to desecrate the birthday of Martin Luther King Jr. Tonight, and 83,000 bombing missions later, is the 26th anniversary of the assassination of Malcolm X. On this sorry evening, the world has seen the pathological real deal behind the sanctimonious rhetoric of Bush and company. The Persian Gulf War is not about Iraqi withdrawal from Kuwait. The war is not about Kuwait at all. Clearly, it's not about international law or respect or United Nations resolutions, since by comparison to Washington and Pretoria, the butcher of Baghdad is a minor league Johnny come lately to the realm of outlaw conduct and contempt for world opinion. What has happened tonight is that the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev and the government of Iraq have reached an agreement whereby Iraq would withdraw from Kuwait, and that is a fact, regardless of anything else included or omitted by the proposal. This agreement should provide for immediate ceasefire, a cessation to the slaughter of Iraqi men and women, and a halt to the demolition nationwide of their water supply, their access to food, their securement of shelter. So what is the response of the number one white man in America? He's gone off to the theater. I guess that means that the nearest church was closed, or that Colin Powell was busy dipping his spoon into the comfort of a pot of soup somebody else cooked for him, and that Dick Cheney was fit to be tied into any kind of uniform so long as it meant nobody would take away his Patriot missiles and Apache helicopters and B-52 cluster bomb bombers and black and brown and poor white soldiers and sailors and all the rest of these toys for a truly big-time coward. Confronted with the nightmare prospect of peace, Bush goes off to the theater because he'll be damned if he will acknowledge that Saddam Hussein is a man, is the head of a sovereign state, is an enemy to be reckoned with, an opponent with whom one must negotiate. Saddam is not a white man. He and his Arab peoples must be destroyed. No peace, no ceasefire, no negotiations. And I am proud tonight to remember Dr. King and Malcolm X, and to mourn their absence even as I pursue the difficult challenge of their legacy. Both of these men became the targets of white wrath when they, in their different ways, developed into global visionaries persisting against racism in Alabama, in Harlem, in South Africa, in Vietnam. Neither of these men could have failed to condemn this current attack against the Arab world. Neither of these men ever condoned anything less than equal justice and equal rights. Hence, the undeniably racist double standards now levied against Saddam Hussein would have appalled and alienated both of them completely. I am proud to shake hands with the increasing number of African American conscientious objectors. I am proud to remark the steadfast moral certainty of United States Congressman Ronald Dellum's opposition to the war. I am proud to hear about the conscientious objections of Congressmen Gus Savage and John Conyers and Mervyn Dimily. I am proud to observe that even while African Americans remain disproportionately represented in the United States Armed Forces, we as a national community stand distinct, despite and apart from all vagaries of popular opinion. We maintain a proportionately higher level of opposition to this horrible war, this horrendous evasion of domestic degeneration and decay. And I want to say something else specific to you, Mr. President. It's true, you can humiliate, and you can hound, and you can smash, and burn, and terrify, and smirk, and boast, and defame, and demonize, and dismiss, and incinerate, and starve. And yes, you can force somebody, force a people to surrender what happens to remain of their bloody bowels into your grasping, bony, dry hands. But all of us who are weak, we watch you, and we learn from your hatred, and we do not forget. And we are many, Mr. President. We are most of the people on this godforsaken planet.
June Jordan. No, she didn't give that speech last weekend. She gave that speech in 1991, speaking out against the Persian Gulf War. She was in Hayward, California. She died last Friday, June 14th, 2002, after a decade-long battle with breast cancer. She was 65 years old, a professor at the University of California, Berkeley. You're listening to Democracy Now! As we speak with Alice Walker, Laura Flanders, on the line with us now from California, Angela Davis. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. Your thoughts as you listen to June Jordan?
Well, I suppose I would say that it's very hard to imagine a world without June Jordan in it. She spoke to every issue with all of her heart and all of her passion. I can remember when she accepted the position at UC Berkeley. I certainly don't think that Berkeley realize how much it would itself be transformed by her presence on that campus. But she's also left many legacies, and I suppose in order to get through the pain of trying to imagine the world without June, I have to think about the many seeds she planted, the many young people who are taking the poetry they learned to write with her, the way they learned to think about themselves politically. June was never affiliated with a political organization, at least not in recent years, but I think she did more than anyone else I know to urge people to think politically about the world and about the relationship between their everyday lives and the state of the world. In that sense, she was really a poet. She was a poet in the most radical sense of the word. And I also felt, as you said, that her talk, which we just listened to, could have been given yesterday. She had the amazing capacity to speak to specific conjunctures, specific moments, and at the same time produce an enduring, lasting effect.
I wanted to talk about breast cancer for a moment. She learned 10 years before she died that she had breast cancer. Laura, you are a dear friend of June Jordan and have gone through the last few years with her battle with it, ultimately deciding not to take the drugs or the medications anymore. You were with her when she died. Can you talk about what breast cancer meant for June Jordan?
Well, I think maybe we'll let her talk about it in her own words. I mean, she called it a national disgrace in her essay Besting a Worst Case Scenario that's in the collection Affirmative Acts. She writes, this is a national disgrace. This is a soft-spoken emergency. This is a colossal loss of life, lost to a colossal absence of uncontrollable, serious, coast-to-coast, around-the-clock, know-nothing-as-usual outcry and civil and uncivil disobedience to a status quo that includes such unbelievably huge numbers of women suffering and dying at a predictable rate during predictable time periods. June Jordan asked, what's up? There is no better question. What is up? 50,000 women die every year of breast cancer. This is not okay. Angela was there when June was first diagnosed with breast cancer. She saw the hell that June went through 10 years ago. We saw the hell she went through this year. Excellent doctors, the best possible care, and still it sucks. There is nothing okay about it. Everything everybody is doing in every way that they try to survive this disease is correct in June's view. Her mission to all of us was stop this disease. How come we don't know the source? How come we don't know what will cure it? How come we don't know whether fat or no fat, or having children or not having children, or, you know, breastfeeding or not breastfeeding has any impact on breast cancer? This is a national disgrace, compounded today by the fact that it stole from us June Jordan, our beloved. It's a national disgrace. We have to end it.
Laura Flanders talking about June Jordan. Her last days, she decided not to take any more.
She had decided in the last month. The breast cancer that she had metastasized to various parts of her body. She had been playing a brutal game of squash or tennis or some metaphor with it for the whole of the last 3 years. She had work to do. She wanted to write a book about democracy. She was finishing a collection of essays that will come out in the fall. She was gathering together a whole new book of poems. She had work to do. The treatment was interfering with the work. The treatment was miserable. She'd had enough. She accepted hospice care in the last 3 weeks, 4 weeks of her life. She died surrounded by very loving friends and her son Christopher. She did make a choice as to how she wished to end her life. It was not tied up to machines. It was not drugged with chemotherapy drugs. It was raging against this illness, raging that she was not able to do the work that she intended to do. But ultimately, to a certain degree, June was at peace.
Junichi Sumitsu is also with us, director of the Poetry for the People, the program on political and artistic empowerment with students at UC Berkeley that was founded by June Jordan, I guess just before she was diagnosed, right about the same time with breast cancer. Junichi, can you talk about June's legacy?
Absolutely. I think that with regard to the Poetry for the People program, it's pretty much the classic embodiment of exactly what it is that June stood for. One of the things that she promoted was this idea that students are not going to take themselves seriously unless we who teach them honor and respect them in every practical way that we can. She was a teacher unlike any other, to the extent that she absolutely invested in her students in a way that is just unbelievable to think that a human being could believe in so many thousands of people who have come through her classroom. She was literally, to me, this one-stop sort of shopping stop of everything you needed to believe in the power of your voice. To me, she was like a mentor, a mother, a microphone, an amplifier, a superhero, even a fashion stylist, and absolutely a soldier. Absolutely.
In fact, that was the name of one of her books.
Her most recent, her last memoir.
Yes.
It came out in 99.
And we're going to break for stations. Some stations will leave us now. Others will stay with us. Our guest, Laura Flanders, Junichi Sumitsu, who is the director of the Poetry for the People Project of June Jordan's. Alice Walker is still on the line with us, and we'll continue to talk with her. And Angela Davis, you're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
I don't know why the rivers overflow their banks. I don't know why the snow falls and covers the ground. I don't know why the hurricane sweeps through the land every now and then. Standing in a rainstorm, I believe. I don't know why the angels woke me up this morning soon. I don't know why the blood still runs through my veins. I don't know how I reach to run another day. I am here still running, I believe. It am a little, it am a little.
I remember, I believe, Sweet Honey in the Rock, here on Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with a host of guests remembering on this Juneteenth, June Jordan, who died last Friday, June 14th, 2002, at the age of 65, battling breast cancer, the most published African-American in history. This is June Jordan reading her poem to rapper Eminem called Ode to Eminem.
So I recently wrote something called Ode to Eminem, that I'm delighted to present to you. I don't have a beat under me, but if you know Eminem, maybe you'll be able to follow this. It's called Ode to Eminem, O-W-E-D. I'm the slim lady, the real slim lady, the real slim lady, just a little old lady, uh-huh. I'm slim lady, the real slim lady, all them other age ladies just trying to page me, but I'm slim lady, the real slim lady, and I will stand up, I will stand up. I assume that you fume while the dollar bills bloom, and you magnify scum while the critics stay mum, and you anguish and languish running straight to the bank, and you scheme and you team with false balls so you rank at the top, and you pop like the jury, the victim, the judge, but the ghetto don't trip to the lights if you flip, or the chainsaw you skip with the rope and the knives, and that bunk about tying who up like a punk in the back of the trunk, or that dope about mothers and wives give you worse than a funeral hearse full of hickeys and hives. You fudge where you come from or whether you mean it, the shit you can't make without sycophants seeing it, but nobody's dumb enough to believe that you grieve because folks can't conceive that you more than a moron, or why would you whore on the hole in your soul? At this stage of my rage, I'm a sage, so I know how you blow to the left and the right, and you maim every Columbine game about no, because he's white. But I am that I am, and I don't give a damn, and you mess with my jam, and I'll kill you, I will. And if you insist listening close for a diss, then you're missing more than the gist in this, because I got your no pose by the nose. I hear how you laugh and cut corners in half, and I see you wiggling a line that's not flat while you're screwing around with more than all that. But I am that I am, and I don't give a damn, and you mess with my jam, and I'll kill you, I will. Don't tell me, you pistol, who's slashing whose wrist, or pretend about risk to a blonde millionaire with a bodyguard crew that prey behind shades and that pay to get laid. What? What's that about fair? I'm not through with you. I'm the bitch in the bedroom, the faggot you chump. I'm the nigga for real, so get ready to deal. I'm tired of wiggers that whine as they squeal about bitches and faggots and little girls too. I'm an Arab, I'm a Muslim, I'm an Orthodox Jew. I'm the bitch come to fake you, I'm the faggot to fake you. Out of the closet, full of the slime you deposit for fun. Rhyme and run, you the number one phony ass gun. Oh, I am that I am, and I don't give a damn, but you mess with my jam, and I'll kill you, I will. Hey, Shady, you know what I'm saying. I'm just playing. You know I love you. Sincerely, Slim Lady. I sent it to him. This is a poem called called Poem for Siddhartha Gautama of the Sakyas, the original Buddha. You say, close your eye to the butterfly. I say, don't blink. I think what I'll do now is I'll read Shakespeare's 116th sonnet in Black English translation. Don't let me mess up partner happiness, because the troubles start and I ain't got the heart to deal. That one be real about love, if I push come to shove just punk. Now hardly, hey, love do not cooperate with cop-out provocations, no. Storm come, storm go away, but love stay steady if you ready or you not. True love stay steady, true love stay hot.
June Jordan, reading her poem to the rapper Eminem called Ode to Eminem, that's O-W-E-D, and other poems. We're talking about June today. Alice Walker on the line with us. I'm looking at the book 50 Black Women Who Changed America by Amy Alexander, and it says more than 20 years before a nationwide debate over the value of Black English gripped the nation, June was exploring the phenomenon of young African Americans who used a controversial form of slang to communicate. June's poetry collection sparked a heated ideological debate over the use of Black English, and she defended the practice as a necessary part of some Black Americans' personal evolution. Can you talk about June Jordan using Black English way before a lot of people dared to publish this, Alice Walker?
Oh, she absolutely did. And I'm thinking now of her book, His Own Where. No, actually, Who Look at Me was before that. And just the way that she managed to put so much of the heart and the soul of people in the language. And she also, in that first book, There were paintings, and so you were able to hear the sounds of the people in the paintings as if they were speaking. And I think that this had a great impact on all of the writers who had probably been afraid to trust that the way their grandparents sounded, the way their parents sounded, was actually okay. So she was even doing that, encouraging young people, encouraging young writers, and just being in the role of someone who said, it's okay, this is fine, this will actually reconnect you to yourself, to your people, to your ancestors. But what I've been thinking while I'm listening to her incredible voice is just, I feel this amazing happiness to have known her and to have been able to hear her giggle and to hear her be happy and to, you know, to be in her presence and to see that shining face of hers. It's so wonderful just to know that we are all lucky enough to live in the time of June Jordan. And I was thinking also how great it would be if everyone on the planet, and especially in this country, could hear her and read her, because she shines the light on all of the conundrums that I think most people are completely perplexed by. I mean, there are people who have no idea what is happening. I mean, it's gotten so complicated that most people think, you know, I will never understand this. I will never understand the Gulf War. I will never understand the present war. I will never understand, you know, how these people got into the White House. I will never understand, you know, them taking away the voting rights of Black people after we have died and suffered to give voting rights to Black people. I will never understand this. Well, if you read June Jordan, you will understand it all. I mean, she really was there. She had that light, the light of her incredible intelligence and her great passion. She had that, and she beamed it on all of these areas. And so as a medicine for the world, I would say read everything that June has written. And if you can get tapes of her reading, I mean, you could hear how she sounds. It's just phenomenal. I mean, she just puts it all together in the most, just, I mean, I'm stunned. I mean, I've listened to her for 30 years, but hearing her this morning, I'm stunned all over again with her clarity and her passion and her truthfulness and her dedication to the living.
Laura, His Own Where, ended up being a great success.
Yeah, it was a huge success at the time, and it was the first ever novel published entirely in Black English, and I encourage people to mount a campaign to get it back into print. A fantastic book written for young readers about a young African-American boy, really, who created a home for his beloved, a home in a graveyard, the most beautiful, dreamlike romance site that he could make for some woman he loved. A fantastic book. Check it out.
I started off talking about June in school, but in fact, she ended up dropping out of Barnard. Is that right? Yeah, she's a professor at UC Berkeley.
And indeed, this last month received the Berkeley Citation, a rarely given award for a professor who has contributed, as Angela said, not just to the campus life, but to the community life. And she was there to receive it. Adrian Torf read her acceptance speech, a wonderful, gratifying award to June in the last weeks of her life.
Angela Davis. Your last thoughts. Angela has just left us, but...
No.
Angela, you're there. Sorry.
I was thinking that as I think back on June's many accomplishments, she was always 2 steps or 5 steps or 10 steps ahead of anyone else. And it occurs to me that now people, particularly women, are trying to make connections between the various forms of violence, the violence of sexual assault, the violence of rape, the violence of colonialism, the violence of genocide. As a matter of fact, there's a new organization and a new movement that is attempting to explore those connections. June asked us to think in those complicated and yet very simple ways many years ago with her most well-known poem, I think, Poem About My Rights. And she was always 10 steps ahead of us, and I think we need to try desperately and passionately to follow in her footsteps.
Finally, Laura, you were with June Jordan when she died on Friday and have spent a lot of time with her over these last few years. Your final thoughts to leave our listeners and viewers with today.
June believed that revolutionary possibility always takes place. Revolutions always take place on the basis of great hope and rising expectations. And she gave us grounds for great hope despite all sorts of adversity. And her expectations of us, of the future of this country and of this world, never flagged. And maybe I could just close with a short poem that she wrote years back. It was called Calling on All Silent Minorities, and I think it gives you an idea of her idea of hope. Hey, she wrote, come on, come out, wherever you are. We need to have this meeting at this tree ain't even been planted yet. We've got work to do.
Laura Flanders, Alice Walker, Angela Davis, Junichi Sumitsu. Thank you, Junichi Sumitsu. Thank you very much for being with us as we celebrate the life of June Jordan. She may have died last Friday, but her legacy lives on. Democracy Now!, produced by Chris Abrams, Miranda Kennedy, Lizzie Ratner, Michael Yeh, Anthony Sloan is our music maestro and engineer. Our website for more information, contact, links to information about June, www.democracynow.org. Email, mail, mail, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.